is 91.7 WVXU's Cincinnati Edition. I'm Marianne Zalesnik filling in for Mark Haney, who's out today. For about a year, Kevin Necessary has been drawing editorial cartoons for WCPO.com. He's taken on dozens of topics from sports to traffic and government and national tragedy. Kevin Necessary joins us later in the hour to talk about his work. First, we'll hear about the Ohio Transformation Fund. People have been talking about criminal justice reform for years, but now this group is putting money into the effort. We'll talk about the goals of the organization and its concerns with the criminal justice system in Ohio. Joining me are Executive Director of the Ohio Transformation Fund, Judy Wright, Human Rights Program Officer with the Ford Foundation, Kirsten Livingston, and Deputy Director of the Ohio Justice and Policy Center, Stephen Johnson Grove. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100 or emailing us at talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi, Marianne.
Thanks so much for coming today. Judy, I'd like to start with you, and just if you can, and I know it could probably take the hour, but in a nutshell, what is the Ohio Transformation Fund?
Basically, what the Transformation Fund is a response from the philanthropic community to get involved in what we see as a really exciting opportunity in Ohio and beyond to make some real catalytic change in terms of criminal justice reform. We know we have a really strong policy community, high level of grassroots capacity doing organizing in the state, a high level of work around civic engagement, and a partnership of funders has taken note of that work and the environment for change right now and come together as a unit to pool funds to support those organizations doing the work in order to add extra weight and extra power to those organizations to be successful in the work they're doing.
Why is the Ford Foundation interested in this, Kirsten?
We understand that the problem of criminal justice, which we see as our system being far too punitive, people being sent away for far too long, is at its root a state issue. Most people who are incarcerated at the state level. And so if you want to deal with the number of people who are in prison and jail with our nation's problem of incarceration, you have to look at what's going on in the states. And as Judy said, Ohio really stands out in terms of the capacity that it has, the policy, statewide policy advocacy, the organizing capacity that it has. And the fact is that these groups have already been fighting the battle to end mass incarceration. So as a national foundation, we're very interested in supporting efforts that have already proven themselves to be successful, hoping that additional investment will allow those efforts to be even more successful, and ultimately hoping that the work in Ohio could serve as a model for states across the country who are trying to deal with their mass incarceration problems.
Let's talk a little bit. You bring out Ohio and you say Ohio really can sort of clear the way for all of this. Why is Ohio so special?
Ohio is special because it has a few things going on. One is there is a real bipartisan appetite for reform in this country, or in Ohio in particular. And we know that criminal justice for so long has been a hot button political issue that people did not want to touch. So to see folks on the right, folks on the left in Ohio, both embracing the need for criminal justice reform is special. The other thing, again, from a national funder's perspective that is special about Ohio is that there is a deep set of funders who fund in Ohio statewide or in local communities that care about these issues. So from our perspective, the prospect of having partners, local funding partners, who we can join arms with, that we can learn from, it makes Ohio very attractive.
Stephen, what is your organization and your involvement here?
So the Ohio Justice and Policy Center has been based here in Cincinnati since 1997. And we work both on prison conditions issues through litigation, but a lot of extensive statewide policy. People might know some of our work here. We have a lot of local roots, providing outreach legal clinics, free legal clinics for people with criminal records. My colleague was actually on this show a couple weeks ago with an employer that we work with, helping people with criminal records remove job barriers. But a big part of our work is statewide policy initiatives, convincing state legislators, doing research and working even with grassroots organizers to push for sensible, smart on crime reform that enhances public safety while reducing the punitiveness of the system. We have 32 prisons in Ohio. They're designed, if you all together, to hold about 38,000 people. And right now they're holding 50,000 people. So we're 133% of capacity. And that is not just a number. OJPC gets about 60 letters a month from inmates suffering from all kinds of easily preventable mental, dental, medical issues, getting abused by guards and fellow inmates because of massive overcrowding. It's just dangerous and unsafe torment to live in such a massively overcrowded system.
How long has this overcrowding been a problem?
It's been growing over the years, and it really began, I mean, the history is in Ohio is not unlike that of states and the whole country. Began in the late 70s, really under the Nixon administration. There was a very, you can trace the roots of the words, tough on crime back to about that era. And from that, we've had an explosion of 300% of the prison system. And that's in, about the case in Ohio as well as other states in the country. The explosion had a lot to do with a drug policy that has failed. We know that drugs are more widely available, cheaper, easier to get than they ever were. So all the decades we've spent penalizing people for drug abuse and drug sales has not made any drugs go away at all. Instead, it's plowed our prisons full of especially black and brown bodies. And that's the most heinous and morally depressing part of all of this is how racially disparate the criminal justice system has become. There's about 12% roughly of Ohio's population is African American. 44% of our prison population is African American. That's a severe racial disparity. Like one in six African American men can expect to go to prison at some point in Ohio. That's, I mean, we wouldn't want any of that for any of our children. And we have to take ownership for that and stand up and say, no, that's not about public safety. This is a system of racial control that we must end and can end. That's the thing. What's so exciting is Ford has been funding and, you know, they've brought me together with other advocates around the country to learn states like California, New York, even South Carolina, Connecticut, some other states have safely and substantially reduced their prison populations. And we can do that in Ohio. We really can.
Judy, why don't you talk a little bit about, you know, Stephen was talking about this overcrowding problem. Some people might say the answer to that is build more jails, not find a way to get people out of jail. So why do you say that's not the answer?
Well, what we know is that a system that ostensibly is about keeping people safe, at its heart, what it's doing is tearing families apart and leaving them with no other options than to end up back entangled with the criminal justice system. So when we talk about the goal of the fund, what we're really looking to do is to reduce the numbers and racial disparity of incarcerated adults and youth in Ohio. But we know it's not really just about the beds or even primarily about the beds. What we're looking at is early childhood education, school discipline policies, access to jobs, access to housing. We know that safe and healthy communities begin with people having the resources that they need and the services that they need and a network of support within their communities. And that's really at the heart of what we're doing, knowing that that is going to have a much bigger impact on addressing the concerns people have about crime and safety than incarcerating more people.
And it's not just about the people who are going to prison. Just this week, a group called the Ella Baker Center put out a report called Who Pays the True Cost of Incarceration on Families? And that report does a great job of illustrating the impact of an individual's incarceration on the people around them, their friends and family. You know, it quantifies the actual dollar amount, for example, that is incurred in court-related costs. You know, when someone goes to prison, that's part of their sentence, but they often have fees, court, you know, fines that they have to pay as well. And since they're in prison, it's their family members left behind who have to cover those costs. So it's not just about building more jails, building more prisons. It's about the kind of price that we want to levy against entire families and communities by choosing to incarcerate instead of coming up with, as Judy said, other solutions which really get to the core of safety, you know, job opportunities, housing, health. Those are the things that really make us safe.
If I might say, I mean, this is a great loop back to very to put local feet legs on that is the recent Urban League report, which I think you've reported on, that the state of Black Cincinnati in 2015, excellent, thorough report that, you know, I know has been reported on here as well as the Inquirer, going into depth about the severe racial disparity that these Black communities are suffering in terms of educational outcomes, income, public health. And the criminal justice system, and I think that's what the Ohio Transformation Fund is seeing and sort of bringing to the fore and putting money behind, is that fixing the criminal justice system is a key lever point for to remedy many of all those interrelated issues. You know, I'm reminded, for those that read The Atlantic, Ta-Nehisi Coates is just a phenomenal writer and had an excellent piece in there about mass incarceration. And he talked about African-American people being born into generational peril and generational plunder, that there has been generations of explicit policies. Even if we look about how Lincoln Heights was treated here in Cincinnati, I mean, there's history behind how low-income African-American communities have been plundered by explicit policies. And what that means today is that people are trapped in an environment, and and the incarceration system isn't necessarily a cause. The way Ta-Nehisi Coates words it is, incarceration is the trap door closing overhead that keeps you from ever getting out. That's why we're so passionate about this work.
I do want to mention, you were talking about the Urban League report on the Cincinnati area, and we are doing a program on that on Monday. So
excellent.
If anyone would like to listen into that, that will be Monday at 1 o'clock here on Cincinnati Edition. We're talking... Oh, that was last month. So something's coming up Monday, but we'll talk about that in just a minute. I'm going to get a confirmation on what that is because I am not the usual host, so you can tell I'm figuring this out today. We are going to continue our discussion in just a moment. We're talking about the Ohio Transformation Fund and criminal justice reform. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd certainly like to hear from you. The number to call is 513-419-7100. You can email us, talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and we'll continue our discussion in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik, filling in for Mark Haney. We're talking today about criminal justice reform in Ohio. Joining me are Executive Director of the Ohio Transformation Fund, Judy Wright, Human Rights Program Officer with the Ford Foundation, Kirsten Levingston, and Deputy Director of the Ohio Justice and Policy Center, Stephen Johnson Grove. You can call us at 513-419-7100. Email us, talk@wvxu.org. You'll also find us on Facebook and Twitter. We were talking, I said the Urban League discussion, that was actually on this past Monday. And if you'd like to go to WVXU.org, you can listen to that program there as well if you missed it last Monday. You talk about the money that's out there now and the work that you want to do. Where do you start? Kirsten, why don't you talk about where the Ford Foundation would like to see the first steps made?
Well, for us as a national funder, we really need to partner with local folks, whether it's the donors, whether it's groups like Stevens. We need to learn about the issues in particular states, because every state has different drivers of incarceration, you know, different sentencing policies, for example, that lead to the most incarceration. So our first step is learning from our partners. After that, I mean, there is momentum across the country on these issues. So it's identifying, I think, strategic issues, strategic campaigns that we might support, and trying to get some wins, because now is the time. The politics of things are right. The public understands that locking up too many people is not making them more safe. So it's important, I think, to make sure that our resources are strategically invested into campaigns, into education, into the sorts of things where you'll see some change soon.
One of the things you talked about, they're sort of, you're coming at it from two different areas. You're talking about things like early childhood education, just to give people a better start, and maybe they won't be in the positions where they would have a reason to be incarcerated. But you're also talking about the punitive society and trying to make things different. Do you start on both ends at once? I mean, how do you do that?
It's a great question, and it's something we've been thinking through of how do you tackle something so huge? And what we're doing is looking at some key opportunities that we see right now in the state that have some policy potential to have implications on some of those other broader societal areas. We know, for example, looking at school discipline policies can have big impacts in that. And some of the groups that we're working with have organized groups of parents who are living with these issues every day and are saying, we want to change the policies so that our kids have an opportunity to be diverted from the what seems sometimes as an inevitable path into the justice system.
Give us an example. What's an example of a school discipline policy that you'd like to see changed or that parents would like to see changed?
I mean, I'm happy to talk about this. Zero tolerance is the word that's often used in local schools. And Cincinnati has been working actually fairly, Cincinnati Public has been working fairly assertively on remedying some of the racial disparity in school discipline. But a town where it's not quite fixed yet is Toledo. Toledo has something called the Toledo Safe Schools Ordinance, which sounds lovely, except what it is sort of zero tolerance on steroids. It's extreme lockdown of school situations. So, for example, what's still resounding in my head is my friend Jennifer, who's got a child in school there, and she sends her son, Xavier, to kindergarten, and doesn't have a pencil, asks the teacher for a pencil, and is excoriated first and foremost and scolded like you wouldn't believe for not having a pencil, then is given a crayon. When he gets that crayon, he is coloring with it and then told he shouldn't be coloring, he's supposed to be writing, and so he breaks the crayon and throws it and is charged with assault. That's the kind of like early training that young African-American kids are getting on you're ready to be a criminal. We're going to treat you like a criminal from the get-go. And that's what these extremely overzealous zero-tolerance policies are doing in schools, so that by the time these young people become teenagers, they're already been groomed for criminal justice involvement. And the police are ready and willing to receive them that way.
Now, someone might say that's an extreme case.
It is.
Are there lots of cases like that? Are they all that extreme, or is that an extreme example of other situations?
It is an extreme case, but it's happening. That one wasn't in the media because it's not unusual. These kinds of little things start very early. They become then, that's why we have 44% of our prison population is African American when it's only 12% of our general population. Because at every tiny step of the way from birth on up, young African-American people are told and modeled through the way the systems are set up that they are criminal, that they are the definition of criminality. And that is the sickness that we are trying to both expose and dismantle and then build up something better. And that's what's exciting, is this isn't just a negative-oriented campaign. It's very positive that we're about building up a community-owned health initiative, community-owned public safety, where there's a voice and ownership in the local community of this is what we want our healthy and safe community to look like, and it's not about criminalizing our young people.
So what will you start? You say you talk about this in the Toledo area. Is there anything particular to the Cincinnati area or Ohio in general that you want to focus on?
Well, the policy initiatives that are exciting right now are, one is, this is such an interesting broad cross-sector of issues. We're talking about policing. I mean, the horror of the Samuel DeVos event and how policing might be remedied. You know, the governor and that whole task force has actually taken some really productive steps in trying to enhance public safety through community-oriented policing instead of punitive-oriented policing. So that's on that side of things. Another at the far end, perhaps, of the criminal justice system, OJPC has been very involved in removing job barriers for people with criminal records after they get out. We were the leaders in 2010 of getting a fair hiring policy here in the city of Cincinnati, so people with old criminal records could get a fair shot at city jobs. We've now taken that to the state, and Governor Kasich, we're very honored, took our entire policy and embedded it in state law in June, our entire fair hiring policy, so that anybody applying for a state job anywhere in the state of Ohio with a state civil service job now, when they have an old felony record, is not automatically barred. They have a fair shot to present their skills and qualifications and not be defined by that past touch with the criminal justice system. So, and then perhaps another layer to all this is sentencing. A lot of people talk about, you know, that, you know, if we're talking about too many people in prison, we got to talk about how they get there, and that's sentencing. Last week, Senate President Keith Faber, and I know this was reported on this radio station, Senate President Keith Faber, Republican from Northwest Ohio, had a press conference with the ACLU and Grover Norquist of the Americans for Tax Reform. You cannot get further left and right than that. And they flanked our Senate president of Ohio to say we must and we can safely and responsibly reduce the prison population.
Our phone number is 513-419-7100 if you have a question or a comment. We go now to Jerry in Northside. Hi, Jerry. What's your question?
Thank you for taking my call. The incarceration seems to be an effect as a result of something deeper, which I would consider the basic cause. And to me, it goes back to minimum wage, that we're giving a wage which does not meet, not able to pay their bills. And so single mothers working two jobs are not home to help work with these kids, and they're getting in trouble. And, of course, the money is part of the drug scene, and that's also part of the issue. So I think incarceration is primarily men, if I'm not mistaken. So if you could comment on that, I'd appreciate it.
Thoughts about minimum wage? Is that an area you want to tackle?
Well, I think the caller is absolutely right that incarceration is more of an effect of policies. I think the choice that policymakers have made so far has been to invest in prisons, building prisons and jails, instead of investing, say, just to pick up on the caller's example, investing in quality childcare or investing in job development and promoting those sorts of things on the front end. And so I think what we're calling on policymakers to think about, and certainly criminal justice stakeholders to think about, is, are we really investing in the right things, the right supports for people, if we want communities to be safe? And we know that locking people up does not make them safer. So what are different choices, you know, that we can be making? I think we have been working under the assumption that the equation is punishment plus punishment equals safety, but we know that it's quality housing, jobs, education that keeps our communities safe. So we're completely trying to shift how we even think about what safety looks like.
How do you decide which areas or which crimes are not worthy, perhaps in your minds, of imprisonment versus those that are? I mean, I'm assuming you're not suggesting that murderers are the ones that are let out of prison. So where do you draw that line?
I think the exciting thing is that when I say earlier we can safely and substantially reduce the prison population, there is extensive data-driven analysis behind that. And so that choice is not one that's knee-jerk or instinctive. It is very much driven by the data. And it's different in every state, as Kirsten alluded to earlier. Each state is a little bit different. Is what we look in Ohio, and right now one of the biggest drivers is not so much the violent offenses, but the parole violations. So we have people who are initially sentenced to parole or to probation, but they immediately get violated because of highly over-punitive and technical violations. They don't need to be sent to prison, that's the only choice, apparently, that the judges believe is available. So it's that parole violation rate. That's something we need to drive down. And people are put on probation and parole not with the most severe offenses, as you alluded to, murder, but lower level offenses.
What are some of those violations that perhaps you would say are not worthy of sending someone to jail?
Well, not showing up for a meeting because, for example, the probation office here in Hamilton County is downtown. And if you live out in Northgate or something like that, and you have to report once a day, and you're supposed to maintain a job, which might be out in Eastgate, I mean, that makes your life impossible. And so that kind of crazy, counterintuitive, just nonsensical policies are what lead to people getting violated and then sent to prison, which doesn't make anyone safer and costs us a lot of money.
And I think another way to think about your question is, how do we hold people accountable for the things that they do?
Mm-hmm.
And really, accountability can look quite different than
yes.
It does. I mean, so far, our criminal justice system looks strictly at how long someone spends in a cage as the form of accountability.
And I think what we're trying to do is get the system to think about other ways to hold people accountable. I know that, for example, we fund an effort in Brooklyn, New York, with the district attorney's office there, Kenneth Thompson, that actually involves victims and survivors of crime in defining what would make you whole. This person has harmed you, and what would you like to see happen to that person to make them whole? And I have to say, a lot of times, the first things out of their mouths are not lock them up for 20 years or 30 years. It's, I want to hear an apology. I want this person to listen to me and understand how what they've done to me has affected my kids, has affected my family. And so I think that there's really a world of possibility out there for how we hold people accountable. But our criminal justice system focuses on just one way, and that's putting people in cages.
So you have $400,000, I believe, to, is that right, to get started with? With the Ohio Transformation Fund?
Yeah, we're looking at a first phase of 2 years, and we have committed about $1.5 million. And we just this week, as the launch of the fund, awarded the first $400,000. So that's where that number comes from.
Where did that go?
It went to a variety of partners throughout the state. As Kristen mentioned, we're sort of working closely with a lot of different groups. We funding went to the Ohio Justice and Policy Center here in Cincinnati, and also the Amos Project here in Cincinnati. That's a faith-based organization doing a lot of work around these issues. It is supporting the ACLU of Ohio and the Juvenile Justice Coalition that are other policy partners, and then a network of grassroots organizations that are really committed to elevating the voice of those people most impacted by these issues. So there's the TUSA, which is based in Toledo, working very diligently on the school discipline policy that Stephen mentioned. There's the Akron Organizing Collaborative, that's one of the leading organizers and organizations in the state doing experimentation around restorative justice, the type of program that Kirsten just mentioned. There's the Mahoning Valley Organizing Collaborative that has a very interesting and advanced process of engaging formerly incarcerated folks in the civic engagement in their community.
And Kirsten, you talked about the Ford Foundation wanting to give money because there was other money here. Who else is supporting this? What other organizations?
That's a great question. We have several committed partners. We have the George Gunn Foundation based in Cleveland, the Raymond John Wien Foundation based in Warren, Ohio, the Needmore Fund, which is based in Toledo. Then we also have some other national partners involved with us, the Center for Community Change and the PICO National Network, that are both doing national work around these same issues. And there's a partnership fund, which is another national collaborative fund looking at civic engagement.
What would you call success in a year with this first amount of money that's awarded? What means success? How would you define success?
Well, please.
As a funder, this is a wonky definition of success, but for so long, foundations did not fund criminal justice-related issues. So one measure of success, I think, we've seen already, which is, as Judy mentioned, you know, half a dozen donors coming together and saying, we're in. So one form of success would be to see that number grow.
Good.
And then for me, I mean, it's not the 1 year measure, but it's the 10 year or 5 year measure, which is, again, I can't say it enough, safely and substantially reducing the number of youth and adults that are incarcerated and put in a cage in some form or fashion in this state. We can do this. And I think that just driving down those numbers is the ultimate measure of this whole project.
Thank you all for being here. It's really been quite interesting. I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We've been talking about criminal justice reform in Ohio. My guests today were Executive Director of the Ohio Transformation Fund, Judy Wright, Human Rights Program Officer with the Ford Foundation, Kirsten Levingston, and Deputy Director of the Ohio Justice and Policy Center, Stephen Johnson Grove. In just a moment, WCPO.com's editorial cartoonist, Kevin Necessary. This is Cincinnati Edition.